I'm very grateful to be with all of you. My special love and gratitude to my very beloved friend Vishwaketuji. Not only is he a master yogi, but he has a very kind, loving, devoted heart. And I'm very grateful to you. Because of you, I get to meet all these special, wonderful people. Thank you. The name of this ashram is Ananda Prakash, which means revelation of the light of happiness, spiritual happiness. Ananda is the inherent bliss of our true self. Anandam buddhivardhanam pratipadam punam ritasvadhanam. Everyone is seeking happiness. It's something we all have in common. There's a principle called Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, which in common terms indicates unity in diversity. And diversity is something very beautiful. In the path of bhakti, understanding that Krishna or God is the supreme object of love and the soul is the lover. So that diversity creates prema, intimate, loving reciprocation. The unity is within that love. In the path of Vaishnava Bhakti, the goal is not to become one with God in our identity completely. It's to become totally one with God through our love, through our will to serve. That oneness is called prema. Within this creation, the diversity, there is no two atomic particles that are exactly the same. And how many atomic particles are there? There has never been two snowflakes in the history of creation that have ever been identical to each other. And how many snowflakes are there in the Himalayas, the abode of snow? What to speak of where I'm from in Chicago? Creation is inconceivable, achintya. There's no two human beings that can look identical or think identical. In fact, there's no... And of all the species of life, the Padma Purana declares there's 8,400,000 species of life and limitless subdivisions within those species. But everyone has their own view of reality. So there's limitless diversity. And if we focus too much on the differences, there's countless unlimited ways and reasons to fight. But in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a beautiful verse, Mamayavam so jivaloke jivabhuta sanatana. Manashashtan indriyani prakritishtani karshati. That this, the eternal soul, the source of life, that person who's the real me and you, who sees through the eyes and hears through the ears and loves through the heart, we are all a part of God. We are all Satchit Ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. Najayate mriyate vaka dachit. for the real self, the living force of who we are, there is never birth, there is never death. These transformations are taking place on the level of the body and the mind. The body's like a car, and the Atma, the soul, is like the driver of the car. When you go in a car, you see through the windshield, just like we're seeing through our eyes. We move forward or backward with our wheels, just as we do with our legs. There's the exterior of the car, which is like our body. And there's the interior, which is like our mind. But none of them can accomplish or do anything without a driver. And the sadness of life in the world today is, although we have developed so much science and so much technology and so much architectural skills, we have so much forgotten the actual needs of the driver. Ananda means to understand the ecstasy that is inherent within us. And Prakash means to reveal. There's a beautiful verse in the Gita that just this knowledge, this transcendental knowledge, dispels all illusions and ignorance. Just as when the sun rises, automatically all darkness is dispelled. That is Prakash, the revelation of spiritual happiness. And Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his verse, Anandam Buddhi Bhadardhanam, means he's explaining that this is actually the happiness that everyone is looking for. But we're looking in so many directions. Long ago, I guess it was 44 years ago, when I was living in the jungles of the Himalayas, sometimes in this area, one yogi told me a story. Can I tell you that story? He said that wandering through these forests is a certain type of deer. And that deer has a gland, and the secretions of that gland produce a fragrance, which we call musk. It's very fragrant. Now, I've smelled a lot of artificial musk, and it kind of smells nice. But in Mumbai, I have a friend who has the real musk. And the amazing thing is when he opens his closet, instantly the whole house smells like nectar. It's such a powerful fragrance. In fact, it costs $40,000 to $60,000 for a kilo of musk, which is just the excretions from this deer. Can you imagine having it inside of you? So the deer smells the musk and wants to enjoy it. So he's looking to find it, but he doesn't know it's inside him. So the deer is searching everywhere, trying to find it. I smell it, but I want to find it. And he comes near a bush. And because he smells the musk, he thinks it must be in this bush. So he starts going deeper and deeper into the bush, and there's razor sharp thorns in that bush. But he's so eager to get that musk that he's going, and his whole face and his whole body is being slashed and lashed. But in the end, doesn't find it. And he goes to the next place, crosses rivers, goes over mountains, whole life, never understanding that it's within him. This sounds like a simple story, but it's actually the story of almost everyone's life in the world we know. Anandamayo Vyashat.
Everyone is looking for happiness.
We're looking for it in prestige, in acquisition of property, nice house, fashion, through movies, through television, through music, through sexual experiences, through fame. But we never really find it. Because dukalayam ashashvatam, those pleasures come and go. Things could give some experience of pleasure to the mind and senses, but cannot touch the heart. We're looking for that ananda, that spiritual happiness that is within us. And then when we actually connect to that, it's an eternal reality. We realize this bliss, this happiness beyond birth and death, and then Prakash, that we become an instrument of that happiness to reveal the light of that truth to the whole world in everything we do. Whether we're yogis, or swamis, or engineers, or business people, or politicians, teachers, or farmers, or mothers, or fathers, we could be instruments of God's grace within the world. Close to this Rishikesh Hardwar area, there's a beautiful story in the Bhagavad Purana. It is here on the banks of the Ganga that Maitreya Rishi met with Vidura. Do you know the story of Vidura? Can I tell? But it's a long story. Have any of you read the Mahabharata? The Bhagavad Gita is 18 chapters within the Mahabharata, which is approximately 100,000 verses in beautiful Sanskrit poetry compiled by Vyasadeva. Dhritarashtra was a blind king. He was blind physically, but he was also blind spiritually. He was meant only to take care of the kingdom until his brother's children grew up, because they were actually the rightful kings. Pandu, his younger brother, who was meant to be the king actually, his children were Yudhisthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula, Sahadeva. They were the very embodiments of devotion, compassion, dharma, and truth. But their cousin, Dhritarashtra's son, Duryodhana, wanted the king for himself. He wanted the throne for himself. And because Dhritarashtra was so much attached to his son, he allowed his son to commit the greatest atrocities against his innocent nephews. Tried to murder them in so many ways by burning them alive with their mother Kunti. Tried to feed them the most deadly poison. Cheated them. And then tried to completely humiliate by stripping their wife Draupadi naked by force in a public assembly. And ultimately exiled them to live in the forest with nothing, giving up their homes, their comforts, their position. And even while in the forest, They were hunting to destroy them. This is how Dhritarashtra was affected by his younger son. But Vidura, who was the other brother of Dhritarashtra, in the Vedic literatures and histories, he's considered one of the greatest of saints. He was so intelligent and so compassionate. He was always giving his brother Dhritarashtra the best possible advice. To be fair, to be honorable, to be compassionate. So on one side, Dhritarashtra was hearing from Vidura, who was the voice of God speaking through him. And on the other side was his son, Duryodhana, who was the voice of envy, greed, and hatred. Dhritarashtra was in between the two, getting both advice. There's an analogy that within every heart there are two dogs. There's a good dog, there's a bad dog. There's Vidura, and there's Duryodhana. And we're like Dhritarashtra in the middle. And each one are trying to get our attention. The good dog is our divine nature, which is the nature of our very souls. To be forgiving, to be compassionate, to be self-controlled and self-satisfied, to love God and love every living being as a child of God. That is the good self, good dog. And the bad dog represents arrogance, anger, selfish passion, envy, and greed. And both dogs are barking for our attention. I think we all have this experience. Sometimes the bad dog and sometimes the good dog begging for our attention. In this world today, the bad dog's really howling, and that howl reverberates through our consciousness, and when it reverberates through our consciousness, it dictates our words, it dictates our behavior, and it dictates the condition of the world. There's so much pollution in the ecology. Why? You see, the air, the rivers, the oceans, the land, the ecological condition that we see outside of us in Mother Nature is simply a manifestation of the ecology within the hearts of human beings. When we are polluted, then we will pollute. That dog is howling within us and dictating our words and activities, then we make the world that. So in this battle, which dog is going to win over the other? The one that we choose to feed. At every moment we have free will. And real courage, real integrity, is when we choose to live by Dharma, to live by principles of character and devotion. Even when there's so much to lose, if we maintain that integrity. Or even if there's so much to gain, if we give it up. And an actual happy life is a life where we live by truth and live by principles, rather than just being dictated by what I can get and how to get it. So Dhritarashtra was hearing always from Vidura the message of goodness, the message of divine enlightenment. And yet he was always hearing from his son Duryodhana the opposite. Dhritarashtra knew that if everyone in the world, his brother Vidura loved him the most. He knew that what he's speaking is true and right. And he knew his son was wrong. But every time Dhritarashtra was about to follow Vidura, Duryodhana said, he would become so angry, he would become so insulted by his father. He said, if you don't do what I want, I will commit suicide. His father was attached. And ultimately, although Vidura was everyone's well-wisher, nobody loved Duryodhana, the son of Dhritarashtra, more than Vidura. Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani kavi hastini suni chaiva subhapi cha pandita samadarshana. An enlightened person sees every living being as a child of God. Every living being as a brother and sister. Every type of human. Every type of animal, every type of fish, every type of tree, every type of insect, wherever there's life, there's the divine presence of the soul, a part of God. And on the spiritual level, we're no better than the insect as far as our identity. We're just in a more evolved state. But the more evolved, the more enlightened we are, the more compassion we have as a caretaker of our beloved Lord's property, as a caretaker of children. To the degree our prema, our love expands to everyone, to that degree, it's actually ananda, real love. And when you water the root of a tree, automatically that water goes to every branch, leaf, flower, and twig of the tree. Janmadya Shayataha. The absolute truth is the root of all existence, from where everything emanates. When we learn to love Krishna, that is means the all-attractive God who has many names. When we learn to love Krishna, when that awakens, then it naturally extends to every being. Vidura was in that consciousness. He was everyone's well-wisher. But at one point, Duryodhana was plotting the most terrible plans to destroy the Pandavas and to create a war where millions of people would die. And Krishna came to their kingdom to try to stop that war. Because every living being has free will in this human life. The freedom to love or to hate. At every moment we have this free will. And God does not interfere with our free will. But yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata. But that one Supreme Lord descends again and again into this world to manifest various incarnations, avatars, religions, just to teach us in different languages, according to different circumstances, how to properly utilize our free will. Who are you and what is your real happiness? So Krishna came to Hastinapur, and Duryodhana, he wanted to get Krishna's support because he knew that Krishna is the all-powerful Lord. So in his palace, he organized the most incredible reception for Krishna. They decorated the palace. They had the most talented musicians ready to play a concert for him. They had the best cooks in the whole kingdom who prepared an incredible feast that was going to be served on pure gold plates and cups. They had crowns and necklaces made out of priceless jewels to offer him. They were going to put him on the very throne of the king, everything, to get his support. They were trying to bribe God. It's not uncommon in this world. God, I will give you this and this and this and this, and you give me this. Duryodhana personified that mentality. And he was being invited. And he came to the palace, and there it was, everything arranged for him. Krishna walked by. And nobody knew where he went. And he went to the house of Vidura, who wasn't even expecting him. He didn't even invite him. According to some great poets who sing this song from Mahabharata, he wasn't even home. Can you imagine? Krishna's coming to your house and you're not even home? Because he was expecting Krishna to be at Duryodhana's house. So Vidura's wife was home. And they lived a simple life. And Krishna came. Oh, our absolute beloved one has come to our house. We must greet him. We must offer him the best we have. And Vidura came home and they were looking for some food. There was no food in the house. Vidura's wife, she only found one banana. How many know this story? Please raise your hand. It's a secret story. She had one banana. And she felt so guilty. This is all we have to offer to our beloved Lord when he comes to our house for the first time in history. So she was pretty nervous. So she peeled the banana. And in her nervousness, she threw the banana away and gave Krishna the peel. And Krishna ate the peel. And was supremely happy. He wanted to show the world that for someone who was motivated by envy and arrogance and greed like Duryodhana, he has no attraction whatsoever for the finest foods, for the greatest palaces, for the most beautiful jewels, but for someone who has simple love, who has genuine compassion for others. He's completely satisfied, forever feasting, even on a banana peel. In this way, Krishna revealed the nature of Vidura and his good wife's love. When Vidura saw Dhritarashtra, in order to protect his son, about to wage a world war, Vidura saw how much pain and suffering there will be in this world. And he was telling his brother, you will be responsible for the deaths of all these people and all the sorrow caused by these deaths. Your son is envy personified. Don't follow him and ruin your life and ruin the world. Dhritarashtra knew what he was speaking was right. But Duryodhana, his son, was listening to everything. He became so angry, he screamed out the most terrible insults against Vidura. And because Vidura loved him, those insults pierced so deeply in his heart. He said the most cruel things against his uncle. And then he told him, as the son of the king, I exile you. You leave this kingdom, you're not allowed to take your family, you're not allowed to take any of your possessions. The only thing I grant you to take with you is your breath. And if you don't leave now, I'll take that away. Vidura looked at Dhritarashtra, the king sitting on the throne. He had the power to stop it. He was the king. But he was so much affected by his son that Dhritarashtra said nothing. Vidura had to leave. According to your Duryodhana, he had to leave forever with nothing. This is the good part. Although Vidura was deeply pained that his loving nephew has treated him like this and his own brother betrayed him after he gave his whole heart and life to help these two people. An unimaginable emotional pain. What to speak of the physical situation of living with nothing in the forest? He saw the whole thing as a grace of God. Krishna's giving me a chance to be detached from everything with a really good excuse because I have no choice. And I can go on a pilgrimage to all the holy places. So he left. Every situation is an opportunity to turn to God. Every situation is an opportunity to grow. If only we open our hearts to perceive it. Vidura began just wandering to different holy places, meeting with different holy men. And although he was the most enlightened person, he never portrayed himself to be that. Whenever he would meet learned people, he would say, please enlighten me. When he would meet great yogis and rishis, he would humbly request them to enlighten him. Although he was more enlightened than almost everybody. But this is a very special quality of enlightened people. They have humility. And in their humility, because they understand the greatness of God, they learn to honor and respect everyone. Arrogance is the sign of a person who's really not enlightened much at all. When we think, I am better than you. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he taught us that a true saint is Gopi Bharatur Padakamalayora Dasa Dasa Das Anudas. That person's joy is wanting to be the servant of the servant of the servant of the servant of the Supreme, of Krishna. So on his pilgrimage, Vidura came just close to this spot where we're sitting. And sitting on a rock on the banks of the river Ganga, he met Maitreya Rishi. And was asking questions from Maitreya Rishi about the purpose of life. about how the universe works and why it works the way it does. And there are several volumes of the Bhagavad Purana which describe the conversation that took place here on the banks of the Ganges and the foothills of the Himalayas between Vidura and Maitreya. Eventually, while Vidura was traveling around the world, the great war of Kurukshetra took place. And just before, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to the whole world for all time through Arjuna. As Vidura warned Dhritarashtra, all his sons were finished. And Yudhisthira and Arjuna and Bhima, they came home after winning the war. And now Yudhisthira is the king. And Yudhisthira Maharaj, even though Dhritarashtra was the cause of so much terrible suffering to him and his mother and his brothers, Yudhisthira Maharaj honored him, respected him, took care of him. And Vidura came home. He came back to his kingdom just for a couple days to tell Dhritarashtra, "What are you doing? You're the cause of the annihilation of all of these people. You were the enemy who tried to destroy Yudhisthira. And now for your own survival, you're allowing him to serve you. And he honors and respects you because he's such a great saintly person. But what is your integrity? Come with me into the forests of the Himalayas and I will show you the way of enlightenment." And Dhritarashtra went with him. Vidura was so forgiving. You see, as we make advancement in yoga, we never hate the diseased person. We hate the disease. This is a common principle. We see the divinity within everyone. Just last year, I was in Assisi, the place of Saint Francis. How many of you have been there? Please raise your hand. There's one place, I think it's called Kanara. Have you been there? I always wanted to go there, and I actually found out where it was. If you want to, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing it properly. But we were on the way, and I was with a couple others. We were in a car, and we were asking, "Where is it?" And one person said, "It's way, way, way out in that field. There's just a dirt road to get to it." So we drove out to this field, and there was nothing except fields. In most places in Italy, wherever Saint Francis or these saints, there's big cathedrals wherever they did everything. But there was nothing there. And then we found one rock. And on the rock it was carved what happened in that spot. Can I tell you? Saint Francis, and they call him San Francesco there, he was walking with some of his disciples. And he saw a few little birds eating some, whatever they were eating in this field. There were just a few of them. And he told his disciples, "You wait here. I have to go talk to these birds." He went to the little birds and he started speaking to them. And as he was speaking to them, so many other birds saw this. Some were in the trees, some were in the sky, and they all started coming down. And soon there were hundreds of birds and they were in a circle all around St. Francis. And he was telling them, that you are so fortunate because you are the children of God. Whoever you are, whatever your body, whatever your intelligence, these things are not really what's important. Every single one of us is sacred and divine and has unlimited value because we're part of God. Now, I'm going to divert to another story. And if you remind me, I'll come back to this story. A few years ago, I was in Mumbai. That's where our ashram is. And I got a phone call from one of my very good friends. He told me that his wife, who had terminal cancer, had 5 days to live. And I was very, very close, like family, with this family. And she expressed to her husband that I really would like to meet with Radhanath Swami before I die. So he called me, and I said, I'll come. And they arranged the ticket. And the day I was supposed to leave, in Iceland, there was a volcano. Do you remember that? And because of the ashes that were in the sky, every single airport was closed in the whole of Europe and North Africa. Every flight was canceled. So my flight was canceled. First day, second day, third day, fourth day. I was helpless. Meanwhile, he's saying, she's going to die, come. I said, well, how can I come? You know, I hitchhiked from London to India, you know, in 1970, but that took 6 months. She's not going to live that long. So I was very helpless. So around the fourth night, my flight was canceled, so I was about to go to sleep. I have a little room with a straw mat I sleep on. And because of some years ago I got malaria, I use a mosquito net at night. So I was just crawling under my mosquito net, and one of my friends came. He just walked in my room. He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to sleep. He said, I heard you want to go to London. I said, well, I can't. He said, well, come with me. Where are you going? He said, I have my own private jet, and I'm all alone, and I'm feeling lonely. I want somebody to travel with me. Come with me. I'm going to Zambia. I said, where's Zambia? He said, it's in Central Africa. I said, well, you know, that's out of the way. He said, if you come with me to Zambia, somehow I will get you to London. So this was kind of crazy because I've never been to Africa in my life. So our altar in our temple, they were just about to close it. And I went there and I went before Radha Gopinath, who are my lords. And I just asked, should I go to Zambia? And just when I asked that question, not verbally, but mentally, the priest or the pujari took a garland off Radha and came over and put it around my neck and then closed the doors. So I said, all right, I'll go to Zambia. So we flew to Zambia. And there, you know, there was this event and the president. I was sitting, you know, at this event, and my friend was sitting with the president of the nation. And the president afterwards said to him, who was that person in the orange robes? Because everyone else was wearing suits and ties and everything. And he said, he's a soothsayer from India. And the president said, can I meet him? He said, I'll ask. So I met him. And then the next day,
We flew below all the ashes. And we went to London. And when we arrived in London, about midnight, early the next morning, I went to the hospice where this lady was. And it happened to be a St. Francis hospice. So I'm connecting the two stories. When I arrived, she was still alive. And we spent the day together. And that night she passed away. But her husband told me, just before she passed away, she told him that all my life I've been a very independent, active woman. She had 5 children. She was really a person who got things done. And if there was any injustice to anyone, she would stand up for them. She said, now I'm paralyzed. You have to spoon feed me. You have to clean my excrement when I respond to nature's call. She said, I'm in a completely dependent condition. I can't sit up without somebody sitting me up. I can't control my saliva, my mucus. She said, I feel so helpless. But then she smiled. And she said, but because Krishna loves me, that gives me ultimate, unlimited value. And nothing and no one could ever take that away from me. She said, I feel infinitely significant, and I feel my life has unlimited value because God loves me. And God loves everybody. Therefore, everyone has infinite value. Bhakti yoga is to connect with that love and understand how precious we really are. It doesn't matter how old or young we are. It doesn't matter how many times we've succeeded or failed in this world. There's no reason to ever be depressed. Because the supreme, infinite, all-beautiful, all-loving person loves us. And if we could recognize that in others, we could understand everyone's value. So St. Francis was seeing that potential in the birds. And he went to the field and was telling them, God loves all of you. Be grateful. Just see what you've been given. You've been given wings to fly in the sky. You've been given... You hear the birds? They like this story. You've been given such beautiful, sweet voices to sing. You've been given layers of feathers to keep you warm. You've been given the whole sky to fly in. You've been given so many seeds and berries and fruits to eat. And so many branches and nests to sleep in. And you don't even have to struggle before them or pay for them. Yes. Us humans, what it takes to get a house and a mortgage and all that stuff and all the stress of having a house and having furniture and what people are going to say, and then if you have a mortgage, somehow or other you have to pay it, and there's so much stress. But how fortunate you birds are. You don't have to do any of that. No stress. You just fly and you go somewhere and you go to sleep and you're happy. See all the blessings you have and be grateful and share those blessings with the world. And all the birds, they were all listening, and after he finished his speech, they all were flapping their wings and jumping up and down, because that's the way they clap. And then and then he said, "Now go into the sky and praise our beloved. Praise the love of God upon all of us." And they were all went to the sky, and they were intoxicated. They were enlightening. They were all going in circles, around and around and around. And he went back to his friends. So this is a universal principle. To see the when we understand the divinity within ourselves, we could actually recognize the divinity within everyone. And yoga is to reconnect. The body is a sacred, invaluable instrument to be used in service. And in the path of bhakti, asanas, pranayam, these are ways of helping not only to make the body a very wonderful instrument for God's divine will, but also to harmonize the body, the mind, the life air, the prana, with the atma, with the soul. And then to express the love that is within the soul through all of these means. Vishwa Ketuji asked me to tell the story of a monkey. May I tell? Is there enough time? Okay, I'll tell a different monkey story. For me, I like monkey stories because I could relate to them. This took place in 1989. Did any of you read this book I wrote called The Journey Home? If you read this book, you'll understand how much anguish I caused to my mother and father. Because I was a student, and I went to one semester of college. I was a teenager. And I decided to go on a summer trip to Europe. And I told my mother and father, "I'm going to Europe with my friend Gary." And they said, "But you don't have any money. How are you going to Europe?" And I told them, "My friend Frank is going to pay for me and Gary." So they told me not to go. But this was in the 1960s. And in the 1960s, it was the most uncool thing imaginable for a teenager to listen to their parents. So I went. And I was supposed to be back in 2 months. But then I became very deeply spiritually inclined. In fact, obsessed. With enlightenment and coming closer to God and truth and rising above the duplicity and hypocrisy everywhere around me in the world. And ultimately, I hitchhiked. Because the first day we were in Europe, Frank got robbed and went back to America. But I didn't tell my parents that. Some details it's best to leave unsaid. So Gary and I were with nothing, but we were free, and that was a lot. We were happier than ever before. And ultimately, I hitchhiked from London to the Himalayas, to Rishikesh. It took about 6 months. And my mother and father, what happened? 2 months went by, 3 months went by, 4 months went by. There was no cell phones to call them on. I didn't write them letters. Finally, I wrote them a letter. And I said that I am I'm hitchhiking to India. What greater education could there be than this? And Gary's no longer with me. And I said, please don't worry. Because God is with me. That's what I said. And there was no return address, obviously. But there was a postmark from the deserts of Iran. So they were worried. And they were helpless, because they had no way to express their worry to me. And ultimately, some years later, I returned home. And then I came back to India and was living in India. And in 1989, for the first time, my mother and father came to visit me in India. In Mumbai, when they saw our congregation and the different projects we were doing and the people, they were so totally charmed. They were coming to my lectures, which was really a culture shock for me. And one time I was singing a kirtan, and my mother and father, my mother was with the ladies and my father was with the men, they got up and started dancing while I was chanting. That was really a culture shock for me. And every evening they would cry in happiness and they'd say, we are so proud of you. We're so glad that what you did. And that was nice for me because I didn't want to hurt them. But honestly, when I was traveling, I really believed, because I was doing this to find God, that God would compensate so that they would understand and someday be happy and proud. And it actually happened 19 years later, finally. So we decided, because they were just in kirtans and in lectures and being with our people and having prasad, spiritual food, we decided they've come all the way to India. In fact, they asked, could we do some sightseeing? Everything's spiritual around here. Because they're middle class American Jewish families. So, you know, they like sightseeing. So near Bombay, there's an island called Elephanta. How many have been there? In Elephanta, there are ancient caves with statues of spiritual people in it. Shiva and Brahma, Vishnu. So we decided to take my parents there. So from the gateway of India, we took a ferry across this little part of the Arabian Sea, and we got off at this island and started walking toward the caves. I haven't been there since, but in those days it was just a dirt path through a forest to get there. So we are walking together. Do you like the story so far? Suddenly, a gigantic male brown monkey jumped from a tree and stood right in front of my mother. And his green eyes looked so ferocious. 'Cause monkeys are really expert at psychological warfare. They know that if they can make you afraid of them, they could conquer you. So he looked at my mother with such evil kind of eyes. And then he moved his lips as high as possible, so his shining fangs and sharp teeth were showing. And then he made this sound. While his teeth were showing, my mother froze. Because he was only about 3 feet in front of her. The monkey suddenly grabbed her purse. My father said to me, "Everything valuable we have is in that purse." My father said, "Both of our passports, in those days, our airline tickets, all of our credit cards, and every penny of our cash, thousands of cash dollars, are in that purse." So my mother was squeezing, you know, the purse. And the monkey was pulling the purse, and my mother pulled, and the monkey pulled, and my mother pulled, and the monkey pulled, and my father said, "Do something about it." So then when the monkey saw me coming, he knew, I don't know what I was going to do, but he was really a mean monkey, and he was as big as me, practically. All of a sudden, the monkey jumped right into my mother's face and went, as if he was going to bite her nose off. And middle-class American women are quite attached to their noses. So in that situation, she let go of the purse, and the monkey grabbed the purse and ran away and ran up a tree and went up to a high branch and started opening it. My mother was quite shocked. This was a culture shock from someone from the suburbs of Chicago. And my mother said, "You're the one that brought us here." And my father said, "What are you going to do about this?" Because in those days, in 1989, India, it's still kind of like that today, but then there were no computers here. The bureaucracy, if you lose your visa, if you lose your passport, if you lose everything, your airline tickets, it could take months of standing in lines and offices of bureaucracy to settle it. And my parents were like almost 70 years old at the time. It would have been terrible. But what to do? What I did is I stood there and I closed my eyes and I prayed. Because when you're totally helpless and there's nothing, your intellect or your connections with important people or any of your abilities, and I wasn't the kind of yogi who could just, you know, levitate into the branch and fight with the monkey. Was helpless. But those helpless moments are so special. I closed my eyes and prayed, "Krishna, save us." And there was just silence. But God's message comes in many ways. I opened my eyes, and I happened to see about a half a block away was a fruit vendor. He had a little push cart with a bunch of fruits piled on his cart with wheels. So I ran over there and I asked him for one banana. He wanted, I think, 10 rupees for one banana in 1989. You can get 10 bananas for 1 rupee in those days. But he wanted 10 rupees because I had, you know. I said, "I'm a swami. I'm a sadhu. You should give charity to sadhus. Bakshish, bakshish, bakshish. And he was just very angry with me. He said, 10 rupees. I didn't have any money. My parents didn't have any money. The monkey had all the money. So sometimes in situations of emergency, we have to take measures that we would not ordinarily do. Because in the Yama and Niyama, one of the principles is asteya. Yes, you're not supposed to steal. And I try to follow the Yamas and the Niyamas. But this was a situation that, anyways, I grabbed him a banana. And he became so angry with me, he picked up a stick to beat me. He was treating me like a monkey. And like a monkey, I ran away with the banana. And he came running after me with a stick, screaming. And he was really a fast runner. And I'm kind of an old Swami. And some people were watching my, what kind of yogi is this? I was running and running and he was running, and suddenly another monkey jumped on his fruit cart and started taking all his fruits. And when he saw that, he heard this other monkey, turned around, and he ran back to chase that other thief. He let one thief away to go and protect his fruits from another thief. So I got away. And then I ran up to this peepal tree. It was a peepal tree. I thought that was auspicious because Lord Buddha attained enlightenment out of under a peepal tree. It's called the Bodhi tree. So he was way up there. And do you know what he was doing when I came? He was enthusiastically chewing on my mother's American Express credit card. I showed him the banana. I only had one banana, so there was only one chance. And he looked at it, and he seemed to take some interest. Then I aimed, and I threw it. The banana was going, and I didn't throw it very good, because I'm not a good thrower. I'm out of practice. But because it was not so close to the monkey, the monkey had to jump. He actually leapt right out of the tree and grabbed the banana and jumped into another tree. But on the way, he dropped the purse. It fell to the ground. And it was open and everything fell out. I put everything in and I brought it back to my mother. And my mother smiled. She said, "That was really intelligent." And she embraced me. She said, "That was so intelligent. You outsmarted that monkey." She said, "I'm so proud of you." In fact, she said, "In my whole life, I've never been so proud of you." And my father came and embraced me. They were both crying in joy. And they said, he said, "Where did you learn such a incredible, you know, way of outsmarting monkeys?" I tried to stay humble. I said, "I guess it takes one to know one." But anyways, they were very happy. Now, this is the difference between a mother and a Swami. My mother reached in her purse, She took out 20 rupees and she said, go pay the fruit vendor. I completely forgot about that guy. That's why we need motherly people in our life. And I took the 20 rupees and went and gave it to the fruit vendor. In those days, as I say, there were 10 bananas to 1 rupee. He charged me 10 for 1 and I gave him 20. The fruit vendor was so happy. In fact, he was so happy, he gave me another banana. And then the fruit vendor was happy. And my mother was so happy. My father was so happy. And I was so happy. And I looked up at the tree and the banana, and the monkey was blissfully, happily eating the banana. According to modern business management psychologists, they would call this a win-win situation. But when the next time I came home some years later, some months later, whatever it was, to my parents to visit them, all the relatives, my brothers, the cousins, they were all telling me, they were so proud of you. Because of how you got their purse back from the monkey. And then they started ordering my lecture tapes to listen to them. So what was a disaster turned out to be a great blessing. Now you may be wondering, why is this Swami telling a story like this? Now I will think of the justification. Because according to the great sages, rishis, yogis, the mind is like a monkey. Yes? The mind is chanchalam. It's sometimes accepting and sometimes rejecting, and sometimes it's hankering, it's longing, and sometimes it's lamenting, and sometimes it wants one thing and sometimes another thing. Sometimes it's happy and at the next moment it's depressed. Honor, dishonor, pleasure, pain, success, failure, happiness, distress, pleasure, pain, victory, defeat. This whole world is made out of dualities. And when we're subjected to these dualities, our mind could really be like a monkey and take us to say really things that really get us in trouble. And sometimes even when situations are very nice, the mind is agitated, thinking about something else, somewhere else. What to speak of when situations are actually really a crisis. Krishna tells in the Gita, Bandhuratmatmanastasya yenatmaivatmanajita, that for one who controls the mind is the best friend. But for one who cannot control the mind is the worst enemy. The principle of bhakti, how to control the monkey of the mind that likes to jump everywhere. Vishayavanivartante niraharasya dehina rasa varajamadasopyasya param drisvanivartate. By giving the mind a higher experience, a more deeply pleasing experience, then it no longer has any inclination toward these lower things. And what is the highest experience? What is the banana that the monkey of the mind will be satisfied with? Love. To feel Krishna's love. To be an instrument of Krishna's love. Ananda. The ecstasy of that love that is within us. And through tuning into that love, through our yoga, through our spiritual practices, we could actually find real Anand, real happiness. and the mind becomes so satisfied with that. It's no longer disturbed by all its troublemaking propensities. And we can find real peace, real happiness, real love, real compassion. And this chanting of God's names in japa in kirtan is especially meant to cleanse the ecology of the heart, to awaken that love that is within us, to realize the sweetness, the beauty of Krishna, and to be an instrument of that sweetness and beauty in everything we do. And this chanting is so simple, but it's so powerful. Kalera dosani de raja nasti heku mahan guna kirtana deva krishnasya mukta sangha param prajet. There's a beautiful verse in the Bhagavad Purana that this age of Kali is a time where there's so much quarrel and so much hypocrisy and so many disturbances. But there's one special blessing. Simply chanting these divine names of Krishna, of God who has many names, one can actually attain the perfection of liberation. Thank you very much.